إعلان مهم، بعد ما تسمع المقدمة في فرصة مليحة وفايدة رد بالك تفوتك.
Those who are doing, and that's my mom used to say, 100% of those who have tried succeeded. Meaning that if you don't try, you will never succeed. And if you fail, it doesn't matter. You will start again and you will have learned from your failure. So yeah, go. You can do it. Whoever you are, you can do it. Trust in yourself. Open up. You're going to make it.
لما قلت أجندة خوفتني في الأول.
Oh, there's always like no على خطر الناس. بس أوكي منهم الناس.
والإنسان اللي مش مطلع يسهل جدا إنه هو يصير لغسيل المخ هذا.
Time مش بس money. Time is everything.
2011 developed depression.
وفي نفس الوقت هو يدق قاعد يقول بقى حتى لو عجبتش يمشي بلع.
أي choice تأخذه في consequence. ممكن يضيع لك حياتك. وممكن يركبك فوق.
واللي كان يعذب فيا كنت نعرف علاش إنه هو يدير فيه.
أنا عم بحاول بس أنه بس رسالة أنه ننتصر على الشيء الصعب اللي صار معنا بس هيك.
أنا متحمس، أنتوا واتين، يلا نبدو. من أكثر الحاجات اللي دارت فرق في حياتي ونقلتني من مرحلة للي بعدها هي التعلم. تعلم حاجة أنا محتاجها في المرحلة اللي نافيها حاليا، زي التسويق الإلكتروني، لغة برمجة معينة، التصميم، التصوير، فن التحدث، حتى حاجات أدق زي فن كتابة السيرة الذاتية. والمهم لي أنا أن الدورة أو الدرس يكون من شخص متمكن، مدرب أو مدربة متخصصة من أي مكان في العالم، والدرس نفسه نبدأ أمتى ما نبي في المكان اللي يمشي معاي من اللابتوب. مش محتاج لا نسافر ولا نولع سيارة، والتكلفة مش عالية مقارنة بالدورات اللي تفرض علي توقيت معين ومحصورة في مكان معين. وبما أن أنا وأنتوا في بحث دائم على الحاجات اللي تغير في حياتنا للأفضل، حبيت نشارككم بمعلومة. منصة دورات.com اللي تكتب بدبل آر، يعني DAWRRAT.com، اللي شعارهم تعلم في أي وقت وفي أي مكان، عندهم مجموعة دورات مهمة، وحاليا ولمدة شهر فقط فاتحين كل الدورات والدروس مجانا وفي عرض خاص لمستمعين دميري. لو سجلت اليوم واستخدمت الكود دميري اللي هو DAMIRI في التسجيل، حيضاف قيمة 50 دينار لحسابك. سجل عن طريق دورات.com أو بالضغط على الرابط في وصف الحلقة. تمام، خلينا نرجع للحلقة. I'm your host طارق الميري. This episode is in English. هذه الحلقة بالإنجليزي وحيكون لها ترجمة في موقع البودكاست themiri.ly بعد نهاية الموسم. This season of the Miri podcast has been very interesting to me. It's also diverse, yet there's a slight business focus. I'm not sure about you, but I feel like I have been thinking about entrepreneurship, business, and growth a lot more recently. I feel that there is benefit to many people to entertain and test this entrepreneurship idea all the way through. In the previous episodes, we covered some aspects of that. This one-hour episode approaches the topic from the practical and applicable side by focusing on what is happening and what can be done in Libya, which I'm sure gives a great insight into a particular set of challenges that many of us experience in the region. I'm very excited about this episode because it comes packed with a basket of opportunities, mentorships, and loans. Yes, direct business loans to help you with many of your business needs. My guest for this Tedriza episode is the team leader of Expertise France in Libya. Expertise France is the French Public International Cooperation Agency. As stated on their website, Expertise France designs and implements projects which aim to contribute to the balanced development of partner countries. In the Libya case, they help with economic integration, diversification, and sustainable development. It is worth mentioning that the Libya program is an EU-funded program. This program aims to promote the development of a diversified micro, small, and medium enterprise sector, MSME, in all regions of Libya. Their key focus is on youth and women. My guest describes himself as open-minded, social entrepreneur with a strong international experience. Alex Châtillon-Monnier started his career in France and has been traveling and working around the world for more than 15 years. My first impression of Alex, although through a remote call, was that he's easy to talk to, fun and very friendly, There was no ice to be broken. He speaks as he thinks. And he shares with no barriers. Alex has worked with Libyans in and outside of Libya for many years. And he is known to be the French-Libyan or the Libyan-French guy. In this episode, we will reflect on Alex's journey, work in Libya, and the hope he sees as an observer from his privileged position of working with the public sector, overseeing new pioneering projects, and the many brilliant ideas coming from the Libyan youth. If you're in business, developing a new idea and hope to one day implement it, or looking for advice, or just want to have a heavy dose of inspiration, stick around. This episode is for you. One thing to highlight before we start, the conversation was casual and sometimes too relaxed. There are some expressions that might not be suitable for children and people who are not used to hearing strong language. We tried our best to mute some of the language. Please excuse the few words that remain. If you decide to listen, please use headphones. I'm excited. Are you ready? Let's do it. Alex, I'm so excited to have you today. Please tell me, how are you?
Thank you, Tarek. I'm very happy as well to talk to you. It's been a while we were willing to catch up. So I'm very good. A bit confined in Tunisia, but we're better than you guys in Europe. So I'm very happy. What about yourself?
I'm doing great. It's second lockdown. So I feel mentally I should be used to doing this thing. But honestly, I did not come up with a plan like my neighbors or my friends to repaint the house or work on a studio or come up with the athletic routine. But I feel it's an opportunity to switch off a little bit, to reflect and to see where do I stand? How do things look like for our future, generally for next year? So I'm pacing myself. I'm taking small baby steps. Honestly, long story short, I'm trying not to stress. That's what I'm saying. So how does it look like your end?
Yeah, it's a good moment to listen to podcasts like yours. It's great. And on our side, it's the weather is very pleasant in Tunisia. And this lockdown does not prevent us from working in Libya. So it's great because we can support more people. So I'm happy that we are not as much as paralyzed that we were back in March. Weather is good, the family is good. So happy. We can spend time. I can still go to the office 3 times a week working with the team. So I can't complain. Honestly speaking, can't complain.
It's amazing to hear. I'm really so excited to get on a journey to understand a lot more about your story and what you do. And at the same time, your connection and journey within Libya, whether it's physically there or sort of this journey trying to push help and support and create opportunities for young people, which is the majority of our audience, the majority of the audience I care about. I'm going to be very blunt with the rest of the audience that my priority is young people. And I have a strong feeling that that's yours as well. So it's okay to be prejudiced and discriminatory that way, I think, because people my age and older, you know, had so many different chances and opportunities. So I would love to start on that, but with the basic background of, let's say you and I met in an airport, let's zoom back many years ago, not this year, there's no masks, we're saying hello, we happen to be in the same coffee shop. How would you introduce yourself to me? How would you introduce Alex in this kind of brief, organic moment?
And the way I would describe myself as a humble entrepreneurship enthusiast trying to provide support to the young generations in Libya with opportunities to get a job, to create a job, to launch their businesses. I would also say that I'm French, I'm working for a public organization, but trying to build or to participate to a better world. In my world, my professional world starts with Libya, and it has started for a long time because Libya is my professional journey for 5 years now.
And that's amazing to hear. I mean, how has it been like doing that from essentially the outside? You are in Tunisia as close as can be. Do you feel like you're missing out? Have you had the opportunity to stay there long? How does it feel to be in it and outside of it at the same time? I'm so curious to know this amazing, insightful observer status that you have. But at the same time, I'd love to know what are and what were the challenges of not being physically there, and what did that allow you to do and what did it not allow you to do?
Being outside, working for an international organization, so the organization I work for is called Expertise France. You can look up on the internet. It's easy to find out. We are in charge of implementing projects to support Libya and the Libyan government based in Tripoli, but also we're working across the country with different institutions in Benghazi, Tobruk, Sabha, everywhere to support young people, especially. We've been mainly working from abroad, from Tunisia, bringing in and out Libyan nationals willing to travel, get trained. We train entrepreneurs. Well, we'll have the chance to go through that potentially later. So at the very same time, working in Tunisia, it's a good environment. And I don't work for the Ministry of Tourism of Tunisia, but I can definitely relate that Tunisia is a very sweet country to live in. And my kids were born here over the last 5 years and they enjoyed their life here. But it's also very frustrating because Libya, I've been to Libya, of course, multiple times, more than 30 times across the five last years. But Libya is such a wonderful country, and we tend to forget about that. And when I speak to partners, to young Libyans, I work with somebody from the team members, tend to forget that Libya is an amazing country for good reason. I don't blame Libyans for not knowing or not having had the chance to explore their country, because of course the Libyan situation was complicated over the last years. But I had the chance to go to Tripoli, Misrata, Benghazi. I've been to Leptis Magna, and I have the feeling that I have not discovered 10% of the country. I've not been to the Thous, I've not been to Ghadames, Togat, to Murzuk, I've not been to Tobruk, nor to Sirte. I mean, these places would definitely worth more than a visit, and the people there are really worth being met with and discussed with, different cultures, different languages in the country. So it's very frustrating because we actually know the country from outside, which is not a really good picture. I mean, not an accurate picture of the country.
I double and second that, what you said. It is a beautiful, amazing country, and it has so much interesting things to see and actually enjoy. And interestingly enough, I had a few of my adventurous trips in Libya with close friends of mine from France. I feel this, there's a French element that is about adventure and exploration that is very easy to spot and very hard to miss. And that friend of mine actually happened to work in Libya for many years, and he's quite upset. He almost cried actually when he got reposted to India because of the strong connection he built with the country. But your travel sort of an exploration sense has been instilled in you early on. As far as you remember, you mentioned your mother had a sense of curiosity about the world. Is that correct? Like, what do you remember from those days? What trips have you done, and what did that teach you about yourself and the world, you know, traveling young?
I come from a small village in France, from a single mother who was working in a furniture shop as an employee. So she was not really... we're not coming from a wealthy background. I'm the first one from my family who went to the university, who graduated. But my mother had always had this interest to travel abroad. And my very first trip I remember is actually Tunisia. And I remember I went to Tunisia, I was like five. For the sake of this podcast, I should have said that the first travel was to Tripoli, but that was not true. So I stick to the reality. It was a neighbor country of Libya. It was Tunisia. And the first thing that he taught me that we were in this touristic place, watching people on a souk buying some stuff from a local shop. And I saw that in the back of the shop, a young boy, he was, I think, the same age than me at that moment, five or six. And he was carving stones for the shops to be sold. And my mom told me, you see, this boy cannot go to school. Most likely, his parents may not be able to afford sending him to school. So it's very important to work at school so that you can enjoy a chance that others don't have. And it's true that the education system in France is free till the end, till the doctorate or master degree. So that taught me, first, the appetite of traveling. And with my mom, we traveled quite a lot. Until I was 16, 17, and then I traveled by myself. And secondly, the value of education. You know, sometimes you have small memories that comes. And I keep this memory in my mind as a true turning point in my life. Very useful. And I kept that along my education. Really, when I didn't know what to do, I still remember this little guy. And what my mother said potentially was not true, but that had left a mark on me.
It left you an incentive, but at the same time, it's not this illusion of imagination. You saw that kind of challenging reality in front of your eyes, and that inspired you to do something with your life. And is that a direct connection? Is that why you spent around 15 years traveling, working, and helping people in different places?
Totally. This is the first memory I have that gave me a real clue that the world is unfair, totally different from a place to another one, where we don't have equal opportunities. And when you have these opportunities, you have to know it and to sense it and to feel like you're lucky enough and luckier than others. And again, participate, contribute to a better and a fairer world. And that is the deep root of my professional engagement. After that, I joined some international organization. I work for the UN and now I work for Expertise France. This is because I want to support the least advantaged people, the most vulnerable population across the world, to improve their way of life, to improve their standard of living, to give a chance to people to thrive. And the chance I receive as a French national, having access, being born at the right place, having access to education, having access to free education. In France, the scholarship and the tuition, for universities is 300 euros a year. So compared to other education systems where you have to pay dozens of thousands for 1 year at the university, we were lucky. So I enjoyed it at the fullest because it was an opportunity. And I thought that I had to give back some of the chance I had to other people. That's the deep root of my engagement, working for least advantaged people, if it makes sense.
Now, coming to Libya, which is a funny place when it comes to that, right? Like, it is not the classical, quote-unquote, developing country, which it's a very challenging terms for a lot of us to consume, because you're looking at this development, not much is happening around it. Is it actually developing? Is it not? And also, who's calling it that? Aside from all of that noise, you have this massive land, limited population, lots of wealth, quote unquote. At the same time, you are coming in with that notion of, I can help do something here. I'm sort of mission to take crucial steps to effecting change. What did you have as expectation? What was reality like for the first phase? What was the situation in terms of challenges and in terms of, wow, I did not know that this exists. This is actually good.
I think the common perception that we have in Europe, although I studied international relations, so I was quite acquainted with what's going on in the region, and I also traveled quite substantially in the Middle East region, in the Maghreb region, so I knew exactly what's going on, what was going on the principle in Libya. And when I came to Libya, we had this perception that Libya is a war-affected country with only warriors. Obviously, as you mentioned, it's a limited population country, 6 million people. So I thought, okay, that's going to be a total war. It's going to be difficult. And actually, the first trip I had in Libya and the first people I met it's totally the opposite. Of course, there was a war. Of course, there was warriors and militias. But most of the people that I had the chance to meet with, work with, support, were totally different from what we were expecting, full of life, full of promises, in desperate expectations of creativity. What you don't know when you don't work in Libya is these powerful young people who are actors of the future Libya. You think that nothing happens and that's war and really people only get to kill each other, but it's totally the opposite. This is a minor fact, but which makes a lot of noise. But the everyday life with people, with the young guys and young ladies creating, going to schools, despite the harsh conditions, going to university, trying to put food on the table, creating, innovating to be resilient. And that's the first thing I had is, we are in the European world, in the European part of the world, we've lost the idea of being resilient. We don't know what it is. We are faggots. We cannot sustain a 2 hours electricity cut, power cut. It seems unbearable. And French, among others, we are going on strike, everything that something happens. So it's a luxury of rich countries. But when you are in Libya and then you have to cope with the situation, you can feel, and that's my very, and I'm being very talkative, sorry, but the very first feedback I had was like, this population is resilient and has a strength that obviously nobody knows, but that is very unprecedented in the recent history. In Libya, you have to find ways, and you always find ways, to live. And that's a beautiful message that unfortunately not enough people convey. And the point of talking to you is also for people from the audience to realize what they've been through and the strength that they have, and they most likely cannot see it. The strength of the living population is just amazing. And having being an observer and trying to help in some occasions people was a privilege. And I don't say that because I expect something in return. I say that because I truly believe it. It's really impressive.
I think you're also at a privileged position to see two things in Libya. You see this resilience, this stubbornness to actually fight and live and change and carry on. And you also get to see the people who are not doing their jobs properly, the people who should be not abusing this resilience and the stamina and the energy of people, and through their bureaucracy or lack of structure, not doing their job. I mean, we've mentioned electricity cuts a few times, but it just still, in a way, does not make sense to carry on for so many years doing that. I mean, many other countries in the regions are suffering through it. You know, Lebanon is a case. But how does that also make you feel? Does that make you feel, oh, you see where the gap is and you see the solution? Or does it further complicate the picture for you having to deal with ministries and people in these assuming decision-making positions, problem-solving situations, and the problems are just stacking up? They're not being solved.
That's the other side of the coin, is individually speaking, young Libyans, but Libyans at large are pretty resilient and innovative and trying to make their way out. That's the best part of the story. Fortunately, we're not online and nobody listened to your podcast, so I can say off the record things. But what I would say as a practitioner of trying to help also in a public institution is that, yeah, indeed, it's not always easy. Libya is a country that works part-time. When you go to see ministers, you can see that after two, there is nobody in the ministries. And you just keep on wondering, how is it possible that all advisors of the ministers are back home at the time of 3 p.m. in the afternoon? Well, I was involved very closely to French ministers previously, and we were working until 11 at night. So 3 p.m. was the end of the morning for us.
I have to say, the Libyan ones have a really nice work-life balance. You guys don't have that. It's much more live and relax balance as opposed to work life balance. But sorry, I just could not help myself to compare that. There isn't much work being done.
No, you're right. That's a good way of seeing things. Working conditions in Libya are quite conducive to a good balance between work and personal life, that I can give you. That's definitely. But from time to time, when you work as when you're a high level civil servant, when you're working to provide services to your population and your fellow civil servant, you expect to be much more involved than the average worker in Libya. And you have a duty to provide services. And from time to time, it may be a bit exhausting. And to see that the overall situation, the conflict situation, the political instability are not helping to bring people to work more in these institutions. But it's not only working more, it's also the way these institutions were engineered back in the days. All these public institutions were engineered in a way to avoid a decent way of functioning. So the system itself has been designed so that it doesn't work very much. It's not extremely effective. And it serves a purpose. Obviously, when everybody has a job and nobody takes decision, there is only one to take a decision. And we all know why it was done this way. Now that the political situation has evolved, it will take some time. It will take a lot of efforts and energy from Lebanon and also from the international community to help having an administration and public institutions on a good track to function. And that's the sense of our commitment, is to guide civil servants from these institutions, ministers, to show them how it works elsewhere so that they could import the best practices and adapt that to their country.
Just to continue on the point you've highlighted, I was purely being sarcastic. I mean, in these conditions that are exceptional, that are not day-to-day, that are not normal, you and I would expect someone to double work, to have an emergency strategy, to, as you said, be in the office 11 o'clock and onwards. So it is actually merited, and it needs a different way of thinking about work in order to go through those things. So that is the expectation from my mind. But the reality is this difficultness of people not being able to see that. And I remember you saying it so well in the first time, that the system from beforehand is literally structured, engineered for not working, not for working, you know, committees, ineffectiveness of processes and so on. So that is quite symptomatic. That aside, like, if you were to look ahead and think, what has Alex achieved? What has Expertise France achieved in the past X years? I think you remember saying 5. What are the highlights? What are the things you're proud of? What are the things that you actually feel are going to leave an impact for a long time?
I don't blame individuals working for the system in Libya. I don't blame civil servants. I don't blame the ministers. I don't blame them personally. I just say that the system, as you mentioned, is not designed to work. So regardless the amount of the effort that you put, it won't make any difference, any systemic difference. And that's why there is a huge need for change. And this change can be brought by the young people, by being involved in the political negotiations, in the political games, in participating in civil society organizations. So the change shall come from the bottom. And when I say the bottom, I mean the large part of the population. And that's why it was one of our strategies to focus on this young generation, to provide them with opportunities to understand their power and what can they do in a country where, obviously, for everyone, we won't think that there is a chance. Because providing hope in a country which is really devastated by war is something that shall be accompanied by actions and concrete actions, because otherwise you leave hope and nothing behind. So what we've done, and I'm not here to advertise only what Expertise France has done, but I'm very proud of a few things. First and foremost, we have supported entrepreneurs, aspiring entrepreneurs, students who were willing to start a business and didn't know how to do it. And across, and since our the beginning, we've helped 3,500 entrepreneurs to start off a business. Not all of them are thriving now. Not all of them are still operating, but a good chunk of them are still up and running. We've been building community across the country on entrepreneurship. And we've launched an online business school, which is called Libus. It's an online business school in Libyan Arabic with Libyan businessmen. We've supported the creation of Stream, which is an incubator accelerator in Tripoli, and that in partnership with Libyana. So for those of you, from you guys who are listening to us, I'm sure you all know Stream, but if you don't know Stream, Google it, stream.ly, and get in touch. Very decent and clever people running Stream today. Guys are really rock stars and spending their whole life sharing their knowledge about entrepreneurship and how they can support you to launch your business.
Who's the right candidate on your end? If I were to ask you, who's the absolute golden candidate you're looking for to apply for Stream? What do they look like? What do they have? And what kind of application should they be thinking about?
So we have two programs. One is for early stage companies. So those who us who have an idea, but not really well developed, not a product. So this is called an incubation. So we have a program dedicated to help people moving from the idea to the product. So you want to launch a business, you feel like there is a need in this field or this field, but you don't know exactly. So we have a free program to help you designing your product and putting the product on the market. And we have another program, which is an advanced program, which is called Acceleration, for those who are already operating their businesses. They have a product, an app, a service, whatever they do. And we help them scaling up, so going to the next level. And to help these two programs, we have a Fab Lab. So a Fab Lab is a laboratory where you have old machines to create prototypes. So a 3D printer, different tools and machine. Go on stream.ly, everything is explained. So we don't have a profile. We are not targeting people from the age of 16 to 25, for example. It's open to everyone, depending on their level of business and their interest. So there's a call for proposal every quarter, and we have between 30 to 50 people that we host for 3 months. So it's fully free.
Sounds fantastic. And you've had projects, you've had many, many, many projects, as you mentioned, from all over. Which ones like stayed with you the most? And when, I remember you've helped someone in Benghazi open up a shop. There's, I think, Morzu, because you're everywhere at the same time. You focus on women. Just so we're on the same page, I would say more than 50% of my audience are female. So you have their focus and interest as well. So just, yeah, let me know what projects are you really, really excited or happy about, something that you won't forget for a little while.
So, yeah, Tark, you've worked this interview through. Huh? You know everything from us, so that's good. Thank you. So we do target women, and we have a strong focus on helping women entrepreneurs across the country. We work with NGOs locally in Morzouk, you said. We work in Sabah. We work with NGOs in Tripoli, in Benghazi, for example, very soon. And I was finalizing the details with the team. We'll be sending two containers that were refurbished, fully refurbished. So it's what we call upcycling. So this trendy European Western language, where we have refurbished a container that was used and transformed these containers to actually into shops. And these shops will be put at the disposal of women entrepreneurs working in remote areas of Libya. So we have people with women entrepreneurs from Ghat, from Ghadames, from Ubari, Morzouk as well. And they will showcase their product in Tripoli and in Benghazi to being sold to Tripoli and Benghazi citizens. So this is something that is very funny to do. And they're also very useful for entrepreneurs. So that is something that I'm quite proud of. Again, if you have any questions, you guys who are listening to us, get in touch with us. We have a Facebook page. We have there's expertisefrance.libya as well available. Get in touch. We're happy to help wherever you are, whatever you're interested in. We're also working on funding companies in Libya. So we, as Expertise France, we do not provide funding. But we also know that if you want to run a business, for example, and you don't have money, you cannot do it. So accessing money in Libya is harsh. It's very difficult. So, for example, now we're working with Libyana to launch a grant scheme. So a grant fund that will be available for businessmen and women of the country, up to 20,000 Libyan dinars. It's going to be released by the end of the year. So if you have a good idea, you apply online. There is a committee, and you could access this funding so that you can develop your company. We're also working, for example, with Atib, the bank, Asari Trade Investment Bank. And we have helped them setting up two microfinance branches, one in Tripoli and one in Benghazi, so that if you're looking at small amounts to borrow, you could borrow that up to 20,000 Libyan dinars in different sectors from these two branches. So through these mechanisms, we are trying to support Libyans to have a better access to money, which is dramatic in Libya, that the money is not flowing, and that's bad for an economy.
Since we're on a break, I'd like to share with you an exciting new project I recently discovered. As you know, continuous learning is a key factor in our ability to adapt to the world that is always changing. Creating opportunities for others to achieve that learning is something I care about a lot. The Miri is about the pursuit of the better life. Dawarat.com is a platform that brings trainers, teachers, and practitioners with specific knowledge to people that want to improve their careers and future prospects. Dawarat's goals are to bridge the knowledge gaps created by the education system, remove accessibility obstacles, all while making big savings for their customers. Today, Dawarat.com is inviting qualified instructors to join their team. If you have a course you want to include on the platform, get in touch by emailing train@dawarat.com. That is train@dawrrat.com. Dawarat is seeking investors. If you want to support Dawarat.com to continue to scale and improve the platform, email Ala Eddin Asghir, the very dynamic and ambitious founder of Dawarat, on invest@dawarat.com. That is invest@dawrrat.com. And now, back to the episode. I know all the details will be on the website, but I'm curious about this one because obviously I'm developing this podcast and I want it to be the biggest in the world, Arabic and English, potentially French. I want to really dominate, essentially. But what's the what is the requirement? Because I know for the stream you mentioned 16 to 25, so I'm disqualified for that. This loan what is the basic requirements? You obviously, you're not looking just for an idea, you're looking for a business for this loan, right?
Yeah. So 16 to 25 was a joke. We're not looking at 16 to 25 people. We're looking at people with ideas, wherever you are, whoever you are. We don't care. There is an ad for McDonald's in Europe where they say, come as you are. It's a bit like this. Come as you are. We like everyone.
That's a bit scary. Like, to me, that invites me, like, showing up in my pajamas and maybe not my pajamas and to McDonald's.
It's come as you are. For example, for the loans, back to reality and potentially stuff that may interest your audience. So for the grants, for example, through Libiana, it's more for tech companies. So you want to launch an app or you want to launch a website, everything that is tech-based. You could access these loans. It depends on the level of maturity of your company. So there will be a website up and running. We'll do some comps. So check out our social medias on Facebook. We'll announce that in December. And for the micro loans, the company's name is Nama Tamwil. So one branch in Tripoli, one branch in Benghazi. You go to them and they will explain to you. So you need to have you need to be registered and to have a business already. You don't need to have collateral, because it has been designed in a way that you don't need collateral. And for example, top of my head, this was launched last year in November. We already have success stories. One lady doing harissa, although funny enough, because I live in Tunisia, the country of harissa, and it's in Libya where I meet people who are actually making a harissa. And good harissa from Benghazi. So if you're in Benghazi, check online. There is a good harissa maker in Benghazi. You go to the branch, it's open. The guys there are very welcoming and easygoing. They will help you through the procedure. So it's Islamic finance. So you don't get money. You get what you need. But they are pretty well equipped. And they rely on ATIB database. So you can access nearly anything you want. And there is a specific product that can help you bringing goods from abroad, which is sometimes very needed when you are running a business. So ATIB and the name of the branches are called Nama Tamwil. Look it up on the internet. They have a Facebook and they have a website. You can access to them. Come to me and I will be happy to share the contact details.
I have to apologize. I'm going to have to approach this particular segment with a lot of suspicion, not necessarily for me, but from, let's say, a listener to say, well, what's in it for you guys and why are you doing it? Why are you spending time and giving expertise and giving money? Why French expertise France in Libya? What's in it for you? And just take it with the full suspicion of like agenda and foreign intervention and international this and that. That kind of conversation, which I'm assuming you hear a lot or hear about a lot.
Yes, because we're spy. We do that because we want to get intel. We get money from Libya. And obviously, that's our goal. No, of course, we're not. But yeah, indeed, that's a very good question. And I can also give you an example. The very first workshop we organized back in 2016 was a workshop on with different Libyan businessmen and Libyan officials. We were thinking about how to reactivate the banking system. So it's very first initial work. And one of the guy, Libyan, I don't remember who was it, but I do remember clearly, the guy was saying, yeah, but you're doing that because you want to steal our money. And I was like, not really. I just want to help so that the money in the banking system flows so that it can finance the economy. So it's obviously a good question is why do we do that? And the answer is we do that for the greater good. So it may be complicated to understand, but I will just a bit jump in the history to give a picture of what we call development assistance or development aid. In early 2000, the most advanced economies of the world gathered in Paris to agreed upon allocating 0.47% of their GDP to developed and war-affected countries. But we don't give directly money. These countries, including France, the UK, the US, Germany, Italy, advanced economies of the world, agreed not to give money directly, but to give it through different channels. The first one is technical assistance. So each country, the German, the UK, France, they have what we call the technical cooperation agency expertise. France is the French technical cooperation agency. We benefit from support, from financial support from the EU, for example, from the French government, but also in Libya from the UK or from the UN to implement what we call technical cooperation project, where we bring expertise to governments so that they improve the governance of their country. So what does it mean? Because it seems very complicated to understand. We've been funded to provide expertise and trainings to public institutions so that these governments can improve the services that they deliver to their fellow citizens. So giving you a concrete example, the very DNA of Expertise France, but also GIZ, for example, our DNA is to train civil servants to do their job on a more inclusive way, to better do their job, let's put it this way. So we bring experts from different things because, you know, running a state is complicated business. It's not something you can do easily. You need to be trained. And when you are a ruler of a country, you cannot possibly be an expert on health, an expert on public finance, an expert on security, an expert on sustainable development. So what we're doing is that we're bringing top level experts from the world, not only from France, but from various regions, including from the region, from Tunisia, Egypt, everywhere, top level experts to train different institutions so that the governance is better. So what do we get out of it? It's actually, we don't, as France, get anything out of it. What we get is we are happy to help. We are paid to help. We're paid to help Libya and other countries to be better and to be on a better shape. So obviously, when we are Expertise France and we're helping people, people tend to feel like France is a good partner. So there is a good image of France abroad. But this is more the consequence than an overall objective. And just to give you a figure, what we call development assistance in the world is something about $3 trillion US dollars a year. So it's not something at a small scale. It's something that all countries actually do to help developing countries and war-affected countries.
You mentioned a few interesting elements, and obviously this is not a political show. This is not a debate show. This is not in any way, shape, or form an opinion exchange. It's really a personal experience at best. And at the same time, the tagline is the pursuit of the good life, quote unquote. What lessons can we share with each other to help each other achieve good in our community, good in our own well-being, and good at understanding our purpose in life? But at the same time, I cannot help but trying to understand how you feel and what you think in terms of France's image currently because of multiple events. I did not keep up with them because I'm a person that avoids the news. I spend so much energy to avoid the news. But at the same time, while doing that, a lot of stuff came in front of my feet to make me feel that there is something. And there's something that was big, is big, changed, not changing. I guess on a personal capacity, what is your take on it? And how is that changing the way you do things? Or has it changed anything at all?
We are obviously a technical organization. Our job is not to do politics nor opinion. We're providing expertise. We're providing trainings. We're trying to help young Libyans to get a better future. We're doing that for the greater of good. We understand that some positions from our head of state and the president may have been not understood correctly. France is an open country, regardless what some people can think about. But France is an open country where you could practice every religion. The French president has also spoken on Al Jazeera recently to further specify what he was meaning with the freedom of speech. So obviously, everybody is not obliged to like France nor to like our work. What we are doing is not coming with any obligation of alignment of ideology or opinion. What we are doing is pretty technical on the financial aspect, on the entrepreneurship aspect, on the strengthening the capacities of the Libyan institution aspect. We're obviously not pouring any opinion on this. So it did not really affect our work because our partners tend to know that we are not in that in this. And I can say it without any problem that I do apologize for those who may have felt hurt by the declaration of the French president. It's worthwhile reading the entire declaration to better understand what he was implying and then to further listen to his interview in Al Jazeera. So I truly apologize because sometimes we may lack of interculturalities. But no, honestly speaking, we didn't have a lot of problem. And people tend to know that we're really there to help, and there's nothing behind it.
I cannot help but think that we've indulged a bit last time into what is an entrepreneur and what advice you can give being in the space as Expertise France and as Alex, who spent many, many years in business. So I remember a few things from this conversation: as come as you are, don't come in so big, or don't have ridiculous, crazy ideas, have something implementable. If you package it to this 21-year-old girl from Hoon who is drafting her first proposal, what are the 3 tips, 5 tips, 6 tips, whatever you want to give for her to have a clear, realistic picture that could take her to the next step?
First of all, I would thank this girl to listen to our podcast from Hoon, because it should be not easy. Secondly, I would say for all of you who are trying to launch your businesses, think with ambition, start small and scale. It means, and I used that example while we were preparing this discussion, Tarek. There was this Libyan lady who came to me once and saying, "Oh, listen, Alex, you're very nice." And she was lovely to say that first. And "You're very nice. And I want to show you a PowerPoint. I want to create a power plant in, I don't recall if it was Misrata or if it was in Garian or wherever, to transform garbages into electricity and help my Libyan community. And I'm an electric engineer." She was about 20, 22, 25, something like this. "And I need $5 million. And I was like, "Okay, there is a market. That's for obviously there is a market. But secondly is, who is going to give you this $5 million? And actually, she was right. She was like, "Yeah, there's a need, there's a market opportunity, so I'm going to build that." But when it's your first business, starting a power plant with $5 million capital to start with is something that is absolutely impossible to achieve. Or you have Bill Gates as a financial backup. So my advice would be to think to being ambitious, having these objectives to start this power plant in a couple of years, but start with something that you could really actually implement on the short run and then scale up. So a couple of tips. First and foremost, write down your idea, because most of the entrepreneurs we tend to help everywhere in the world, and I was before working in Tunisia, and before I was working in West Africa, and I was working in Asia as well. It's the same. When we start a business, we have the idea in mind, but we don't write it. Write it. There is business model canvas everywhere on the internet. You go on Libus, the platform I was referring to. You find this. It's easy. You write down your idea. And by writing down your idea, you would understand if it's feasible or not. And that would help you building your product or your service. Then secondly, share this idea with somebody else. There is this common thing in Libya that if you have a business idea, you can't share it because your idea is going to be stolen. But the value that you create is not in the idea, is in the implementation of this idea. So an idea worth nothing. What is the value of your business is the way you have implemented it. So share your idea. That's the only thing that gets value when you share it. So it's truly important to understand that if you keep your idea for yourself, you won't be able to reach out markets. I'm giving you a concrete example, and not in Libya. Yesterday, I was involved in a discussion with a startup based in Europe. They were willing to launch a tool to evaluate the safety of different regions of the world. And they were like looking at options, and they had this idea of being able to predict what will be the security in these areas of the world in the next 3 months. And I was like, how can you predict? And then we were talking about Libya as an example. And I was like, how can you know, even though you have artificial intelligence modules, how can you possibly know how it's going to happen in Libya in 3 months? Nobody knows. Even Libyan people, they don't know. But it would be your added value is to be able to say, listen, in this area, in the next 7 days, we feel like there will be no problems, no security problems, because in the previous experience, in the previous moments where there was a problem, there was these low intensity factors that brought to a higher level of violence. And you can, using these factors, these elements you can feel and you could predict if something will happen over the next 2 or 3 days, but not 3 months' time. This seems totally realistic. And this guy, by sharing his ideas with different practitioners, different people, had his business model changing. So this is to illustrate that you need to share your business idea with people. And don't stop if somebody tells you that it's not possible. Just think again. So writing down, sharing your idea, and getting a mentor. So share your idea with somebody who and different people who were involved in the business, who will tell you. If it's your first business, you don't know how a company works. You don't know how to get funding. You don't know how what is a customer service. Talk to businessmen and businesswomen. Share the experience. Take whatever you want from them, but talk to them. Know how to run a business is by sharing experience with businessmen and businesswomen. And fourth, you need determination. You need creativity to think out of the box. You can make it. Don't feel like you can't make it. Nobody can tell you that you cannot make it. You can make it. What will make a difference is you, the strength, the power you'll put in your idea, and your determination to make it work. So you can make it, and be sure of that.
I'm certain you put it in a lot of clarity and coming from experience. And I'd like to use this podcast as an example of that, as this podcast idea has been in my head for years. It did not see the day in light until I've decided to produce and share. And then the development started. The phases kept changing from just an idea on paper to actually solving real problems related to it. You know, who's going to listen to it? What topics should be covered? How should it be filmed, recorded? The fact that I took the first step to create shifted the gears to execution, as opposed to this very theoretical idea. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? And obviously, when you ask your friends and even people who had never experienced this before, they will tell you it's not going to work. No one listens to podcasts. It's not going to work. Libya doesn't have internet. It's not going to work. The Libyan dialect is so complicated. A year on, this podcast is number 15 globally business charts, number 15 globally on the education chart on all languages. It's been listened and shared to all over the region, and I'm having amazing guests like yourself. I have prize-winning authors and journalists who's been having careers for many years. So none of it would have happened if I was just pitching and waiting for money to come in, as opposed to taking practical steps in order for it to spread, to exist, to get a chance to be tested. And now a big chunk of the audience is constantly asking, how can I do it? Where do I start? And the advice is exactly what you've given. Just believe in yourself, be stubborn, ask the right people, get advice, and share it. Basically, it is the most interesting thing that takes place and makes an idea alive is to share it.
Yeah, you're right. You're the true example on something that has started and is getting up and progressing. And when we are not an entrepreneur, when we are on the verge of trying something, whether you innerly inhabited by the desire of launching a business because that's what you want to do, or because you see an opportunity and you don't have a job, or you want to change your job and you see an opportunity, you want to launch your business. Whatever situation is, go, trust yourself and be open-minded. Really, don't hesitate to fail. In the Arab world, it's the failure is difficult to cope with, but it's difficult to cope with everywhere in the world. And those who are doing, and that's my mom used to say, 100% of those who have tried succeeded, meaning that if you don't try, you will never succeed. And if you fail, it doesn't matter. You will start again and you will have learned from your failure. So yeah, go. You can do it. Whoever you are, you can do it. Trust in yourself. Open up. You're going to make it.
We are sort of at the exit phase of this, but it's all about you and your experiences against this theme of the pursuit of the better life. So very silly question, but I always find it interesting what people pick. So what is a product that you bought in the last 6 months, last year, under $100 that really made your life better? If it's not something that you bought, what is a decision, one decision that you made that really improved your life recently?
I would say two things. One decision and one something that I bought. Is a decision is that, you know, sometimes it's not always fun to work for a big organization like Expertise France, where you have a lot of where you have a lot of pressure, where you also have a lot of processes. And when you work in countries, it's all the laws are not the same than in Europe. So all the processes of European companies cannot really apply in conflict affected countries. Sometimes I had a hard time and I wanted to leave, and I truly wanted to leave Expertise France at some point. But I decided to stay because I thought that, okay, despite the sometimes the difficult environment, internal, external environment, what we are doing is actually making a change. The way we are doing our job, not everyone, not everywhere, but the way I am doing the job and the way I have the team working with me is doing the job is really impactful. And the decision of staying, the decision of coping with the what I would call adversity, internal adversity, was a good decision because it fulfilled me with continuing working for Expertise France in Libya, fulfilled me with the pleasure of doing something that matters. What I want to express behind that is to explain that sometimes you have to deal with difficult moments, and that Libyan people know that very well. But including in your professional life, including in your personal life, you deal with difficult, complicated moments where you just want to throw all away, but then you cope with it because you have a greater purpose. I do not regret my decision. Secondly, and that is, I bought for my wife a painting of a Libyan artist, a calligraphy of the names of my kids in Arabic calligraphy. And this painting is in my living room. And every time I look at it, I see with these bright yellow, reddish and blue colors, I see the junction of the two worlds, my world and the Libyan world. And that will stay with me for a long time. And that fills me with joy.
Nothing like art to sort of frame a memory and frame a connection. Actually, that's one thing that my wife and I are trying to spend a lot more time thinking about, of what to bring to the house and what value does that bring us. And there's this thing that's quite cool in London called the Affordable Art Fair. We got lucky that we visited the last one last year. The next one is happening online. They have a website actually, and it's basically exhibitors from all over the world that come and view it. The word affordable is tricky, and not a lot of it is affordable, but it's so enriching just being in that space and looking at art and reconnecting. This cannot help me but think of the future. So how long are you in this for, and what is the next step? And then what does the future look like for Alex? Also, if there is something that's planned in the future for Expertise France, please do share it as well.
I will be leaving Libya, unfortunately, next year. I would have been working for Libya full-time 6 years. I'll be moving to Algeria, most likely, to run another project for Expertise France on economic development in Algeria. But the team will remain, obviously. Somebody will come to replace me, somebody way better than me, and the team will keep on working. We will welcome additional fundings from different partners. The EU is and us are working toward an additional 8 million euros funding to support entrepreneurs. So we'll be composed of an incubator accelerator abroad for Libyan nationals and some seed funding. We will also working at expanding our current work with on microfinance, current work with the Central Bank of Libya, providing better funding sources for entrepreneurs, and carrying out our work with the different ministries. Very soon will be released, and that's a top-notch information, is we'll be releasing soon an online portal where entrepreneurs can register their company, so directly from your living room, in your couch, you can get online, register your company, and then operate with all credits and information. So this is what the future look like for us, is expanding our business in Libya, keeping on supporting Libyan national, keeping listening your podcasts, and myself going to Algeria, most likely in family, and welcoming a new baby in the family. My wife is pregnant, and we are expecting a second son.
It's amazing. It's very exciting for you. I know the feeling of expecting is just so... It's the best product you can create and bring into the world, much better than any company, to be honest. I'm not going to let this pass, the news that you just released. Did you just say someone's going to be able to sit on a laptop from their house, not wearing even socks, and register a company in Libya?
Yep. Now picture people not wearing socks in their living room in whatever city of Libya and registering. Now I have this picture in mind. So yeah, but that is totally possible. You can also not wearing the veil. You can also not wearing whatever you want. It's free. You can register online.
I hope some people in the sort of the admin side of things are listening to this and excited about removing a lot of the bureaucracy. Alex, I have a confession to make, to be honest. I approached talking to you with a lot of skepticism because I have a certain view of people from the international scene being involved in Libya. A lot of them come with certain prejudices and ideas. A lot of them come with this expertise in mind that they know the world much better than anyone else. And that really informs all the way through how they do things and what they leave behind and the damages that they leave behind. In your case, I have so many good stories of random people that know you from the inside, that worked with you around. And the image has been consistent. Oh, it's the Libyan guy that just happens to be French, or the guy that understands us best. And there's so many jokes around that. And to be honest, I am so relieved and excited and so happy that I got a chance to talk to you multiple times. And I do feel this really genuine care, this really genuine feelings that you have towards this country, the people, and how much you are yourself. You know, with the criticism that you're honest to share, with the ideas that are great that you want people to know, and the humbleness, which I really do not see in many people generally, including Libyans, to be honest and be fair. So I really thank you, and you have sort of sealed my trust in humans in general, no matter where they come from. So thank you so much for your time, and thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you very much. Thank you for hosting me, and thank you for these nice words. I most likely you talk to dozens of people that I've paid recently to say nice things about me. So that I see that I manage in a way of having a good reputation. It cost me a bit, but you know, at the end of the day, it's worth it. Your podcast is well listened, so now that will be exponential. No, thank you very much. Well, we also have this, and I have to confess that we always have this feeling about international community coming from abroad, imposing things on people. Most of the international community members are actually humble people, a part of UN people. No, I'm joking. I would have a problem with the UN. No. We're all professionals willing to really help. Sometimes our message is not going through. Sometimes because we are driving big 4x4 in the streets of Tripoli because that's our security regulations. And then we feel like we are not accessible, which is a shame, because what we all do, we all want to do is to positively impact people's life. That's the inner sense of our engagement, and sometimes not all of us manages to convey that. But if at least I can have convinced you that our intentions are really genuine and that we really want to help people, I would have succeeded my journey in Libya, hoping that the people I had the chance to meet with, I will see them again in an open Libya soon, and potentially all together in the desert and in Ghadames, which I really die to see one day.
I hope you will get to achieve those goals. Thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Tariq. Bye-bye.
This is it for this week. I've been your host, Tariq Almiri. Graphic design by Nanka Designs. Motion graphics by Mustafa Bin Omran. This is it. See you next week.